Our next speaker is Dr. Beckerman, who's going to talk to us about elimination of pediatric HIV/AIDS. And welcome.
Thank you very much. It's just such a pleasure and a privilege to be here. I actually have been living in the Czech Republic for the last 2 months. So not only is it wonderful to be here with such a wonderful group, such a knowledgeable expert group, but also to speak English all the time is just such a luxury. I want to start out right away with a few considerations. Here's a recent ad for... I think it's for maternal child HIV and prevention of transmission. And this beautiful pregnant abdomen is labeled, I am safe. And my question to you all is, well, who is safe? When we consider maternal to child transmission, we're always, it seems, talking about the baby. And all you want to do is make a baby safe. And I'll just put it to you that the great advances we've made in the almost elimination of new pediatric AIDS in the United States has been directed at optimizing maternal care and maternal health, and that's just naturally spilled over almost miraculously into the elimination of transmission to babies. So I have no disclosures, and I have a couple of learning objectives I'd like you to think about. I'd like you to come away at least with active thinking about different indications for pre- and post-exposure HIV prophylaxis before, during, and after pregnancy. We haven't talked about it a lot so far, but really pregnancy is a great time for overkill for prophylaxis in terms of women who are not infected. And we can't do too much to prevent the transmission to women before pregnancy, particularly during and especially after. And we'll be looking at a couple cases of that as we go through the next half hour. We'll talk about I'd like you to be able to describe the benefits of initiation of ARVs during the acute phase of infection, during and outside of pregnancy. This is a topic that you're all very familiar with in other contexts, but I'm going to propose that it's even more important in the context of pregnancy and reproductive health. And then I'd like you to be able to list 4 indications for viral load testing for an HIV antibody negative woman who is pregnant. So our goals will be to examine the principles of elimination of pediatric AIDS and how that is different from the eradication of pediatric HIV. We're going to look at where we are now, what we faced in the past, what we're looking at in terms of our failures today, and we're going to ask, will eradication always lie beyond our reach? To read a lot of the literature as they define different parameters for what it means to eliminate maternal-to-child transmission, they're really pretty generous, and in many ways, we're doing a lot better than elimination right now in many parts of our country. And then I'll just sort of tweak this a little bit at the end to ask you who is going to be the second cure after the Berlin man. And I'm going to ask you, well, maybe it could be a woman who was discovered with incident HIV during her pregnancy. Okay, first question. Please answer what you think is right, not what I want to hear. And among U.S. women who are diagnosed with HIV and in care and on combination antiretroviral therapy, the risk of maternal-to-child transmission is closest to 1, 50%, 2, 25%, 3, 10%, 4, 2.5%, and 5, 0%. And I hope I get the Beatles. Okay, well, you all are much more knowledgeable than the group I spoke to in Albany just about 5 months ago, where there was an inverse curve with many people actually entering the value of 50% and very few people getting the 0% number. We're not at 0%, and we're going to be talking about that a lot, but the actual transmission rates in the U.S. right now are between 0.6 and 1.1%. And that number tends to vary because the denominator, in other words, the total number of women giving birth each year, varies from study to study and estimate to estimate. In New York State, which is one of the highest prevalence states in the country for women, we are looking at between 2012 and 17 transmission rates between 0 and 0.8%. So, yeah, the closest number there is not 2.5%, as many of us would have said a couple of years ago even. It really is 0% now. The flip side of that is that we're now able to tell our clients coming in that if you stay on your meds, if you come in for care, you are going to be looking at a 99-plus percent chance that your baby is not going to be infected, which for anybody who's been doing this for more than 20 years is something I don't think that anybody, any of us in 1998 would have dreamed of being able to counsel our clients. So I don't think anybody's mentioned Washington, D.C. so far, and I just thought we had to acknowledge where we are today, and I think this National Harbor Resort is somewhere right down here, and Washington, D.C., of course, was originally laid out by the Founding Fathers as a diamond traversing the Potomac. The piece of it that lay in Virginia was given back to Virginia in the Great Virginia Retrocession of 1836. I learned in, I think, eighth grade history that that was because the borders of the city were not defensible, that they needed to withdraw them to the Potomac. Actually, according to Wikipedia, it's nothing of the sort. It was a move to preserve the balance in favor of the active major slave trade market that was in Alexandria at that time. So there's our history. And what we have to answer for today. What else about the District of Columbia? Well, as recently as 2010, the seroprevalence here was as higher than anywhere else, as it's sort of an isolated city unto of itself, at 3.2%, which was higher than a number of the countries that the United States was sending extensive aid to for their HIV epidemics through the PEPFAR program. It's an impressive achievement that D.C. has brought down seroprevalence considerably as of 2017. We're looking at 1.9% here now. And that decrease has happened in all categories of individuals. But interestingly, in Africa, the countries that were lower seroprevalence have not changed that much, and some of them have actually increased ever so slightly, especially Congo, if you see it's gone from 1.3 to 3.2% transmission. Which is just to say that locally on the ground, you can't really generalize. It's not always that meaningful to say, well, in Africa or well, in the United States. I work in the Bronx. Oh, I just wanted to say, and the perinatally acquired HIV/AIDS in Washington, D.C. also reflects the great triumph against transmission that we've seen all over the country and in the developed world, and we're starting to see in Africa. And I just want you all, though, to see, yes, we have this precipitous drop. Here this seems kind of late. I'll show you New York State data. And here we are out here. And not only do we still have what some people are now calling residual transmissions, one or two transmissions a year, but we also see this continued disconnect. Kids aren't being diagnosed in the year they were born, and that was certainly very true, painfully true in 2005, but it's even persisting out here. Some children are being born not even knowing that they're exposed, and they present with advanced disease later on. So we have two problems. Number one is that their moms aren't getting diagnosed, and number two, that they're not being diagnosed as being at risk. I can't speak a lot about details and case studies from Washington, D.C., but I can speak about details from New York State, and most in particular to the South Bronx, where I work now. And this beautiful, beautiful slide put together by the New York State Department of Health really tracks the decline of maternal to child, mother to child transmission. This precipitous, I almost call it a first phase drop in transmission, which interestingly enough started in 1990 with OI prophylaxis. And we were talking a little bit before about how critical that's been in the history of the epidemic. And so here we are, OI prophylaxis begins, then mono and dual treatment strategies by 1994. We also, of course, had the ACTG 076 result. Women started taking monotherapy, or as I prefer to say, monoprophylaxis. We added Combivir to that, and HART. Very long in coming in terms of perinatal guidelines, the universal acceptance of giving women combination therapy during pregnancy for their health and to assure absolutely the lowest possible transmission risk. And then here we are out here in a sort of a second or third phase of falling of the epidemic of transmission rates, where combination therapy for all and PrEP, PEP, and of course U equals U. So, but if we move on, what I'm going to focus on out here, and there's a bar missing from 2018, are the transmissions that we still see. And this is not New York State data. I've just stuck in these cases from my own experience. And I think that these are not something that we can just say it takes for granted, like, well, isn't it good enough? You know, 99.5% reduction in transmission rates. Well, I would just put to you that if this was some kind of cancer, if it was a child falling into a well or anything like that, no, that's not good enough. A single case of polio in Egypt is a really big deal. And I think that my own personal opinion is that a case of pediatric HIV should be no less a big deal than a dreadful cancer or a violent death or anything else. Our goal is to keep all our children safe and healthy. What do a lot of children who do get AIDS or do have HIV have in common? Well, it is that 44% of them, their mothers were never tested until in labor or even afterwards. So this is a huge loss. And even here you see that 17% in this nice study the CDC, it's on their website, 17% of kids who were infected were diagnosed after birth, and only 5% were diagnosed at birth. So this is, their moms were diagnosed at birth. So it was pretty standard in the 80s where women would learn of their HIV infection when their children got PCP. I'm sure many of you can remember that, and we feel like we're way past that, but I'm going to challenge that today. We don't have a lot of time to spend on nuts and bolts of elimination of pediatric HIV. The main thing I can say is that if we can, number one, treat women, optimize women's therapy, and work toward eliminating HIV in women, we will eliminate pediatric HIV. Key, of course, is diagnosis and identifying women with HIV before and during pregnancy. In New York State, we're very comfortable now with universal opt-out testing and retesting in the third trimester. I would say in my clinic, it's exceedingly rare. Maybe one woman a year doesn't want to be tested, maybe one woman every 2 years. And the reason for that is that this has become normative. Women expect it. It's not a big deal. They accept it just as much as they accept testing for syphilis, even though the chance of them having syphilis or getting syphilis is lower than HIV. Nobody objects to getting screened for chlamydia and GC, and that's normative testing. Reproductive counseling is a theme we'll talk about more in the workshop today, but that can be 10 seconds of a visit with any provider, whether subspecialty, specialty. This is not something that should be excluded to the realm of the send them to GYN or let's see what OB says or let OB talk to her about that. No, this we have to touch on this at every single visit, and they can be very easy questions. How are you doing? For a woman who has no children, you can just say, what are your thoughts about having a family? And she can say, well, it's none of your business. But she might say, well, you know, I really think about it a lot. I really want to have kids. Ding, 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 ding. That's time to start strategizing, trying to start for a little education. If you don't have time today, well, then reschedule a visit sooner than you might have to start addressing that. Optimizing health for all illnesses. I will tell you that treating HIV now in my practice is much easier than treating maternal type 1, type 2, and gestational diabetes. Those are really tough, and they're a challenge every day. Women go through a lot to try to take care of themselves with those illnesses, and they're really tough. And we can't ignore them just because we're focused on HIV. Controlling maternal viremia, combination therapy for all, close monitoring of the viral load. And I have to say I send an awful lot of viral loads, and I never hesitate if there's a question in my mind whether mom is under control or what's going on. I'll send one every 2 weeks if I'm concerned about it. And I'm very fortunate in my setting, which is nothing special. Nobody seems to give me a hard time about it. Durable viral maternal viral suppression, access to once daily pill formulations, and enhancement of service coordination. And just, I don't think anybody, maybe somebody's shown a silo slide, but I found this here. This is a problem every day of every week that we work, and we've just got to eliminate these. I don't know how to do it. I long for the days when a hospital had a lunchroom for doctors and care providers where you could sit and meet colleagues from all over the place. It's really important to share grand rounds, to cross so you know a colleague's name in another department. It's easy to get on the phone with them. We just cannot be isolated from each other because that does nothing but to destroy our patients' health and their care. And then, of course, in the case of pregnancy, close coordination between OB, ID, and pediatrics. In particular, I have I have good relations with all of my colleagues, and I just say that even if you all think that OB doesn't know a lot about HIV, you can still involve them very heavily in decisions. If you're thinking about changing a medicine, even though you don't think the obstetrician will have much to say about it, why not call and say, you know, this is going on, I've decided to change her to that, just wanted to see what you think. We've got to be talking to each other to enhance our patients' care. So, no silos. We have a lot of assumptions these days. One of them is that if a woman gets tested with an antibody test, that's going to tell us exactly what's going on with her, and as you all know, it's not. The other thing I would just challenge you is to consider submitting your cases of exposures, especially exposures to the newer drugs, to the antiretroviral pregnancy registry. This is the largest registry in history, over 23,000 cases prospectively submitted. The problem is that HIV therapy is moving so quickly that, you know, we have 4,000 cases of 3TC exposures, but we're not using that much 3TC anymore. Same with AZT. And now I'll just show you that more recent drugs, we only have 500 cases of darunavir exposure in the first trimester. That's good. It's better than nothing. It certainly is much, much better than the number of reports we have for bictegravir, which is zero. So if you have a patient, a woman on bictegravir, she comes in pregnant, think about submitting her to the registry. Every case counts, especially this early on. I'll tell you that when efavirenz when the big efavirenz scare came out and we had no data, and the first 8 cases of live births of kids with first trimester efavirenz exposure came in, and we at the registry, everybody said, well, 8 cases, it doesn't mean a thing. But when I told one of my patients who had been on efavirenz and got pregnant that there were now 8 normal babies born after efavirenz exposure, she burst out crying. And so statistically, these things may not mean a lot, but everything means a lot. And the sooner we know, the better. And especially the sooner we know it's safe, the better, because then we can much more liberally prescribe these meds and give these women the best absolute treatment that they certainly deserve. And just also to tell you that dolutegravir is still at 229 first trimester reports. And in the new upcoming release of the interim report from the APR, which is easily accessed online at that website, we have conception exposures and first trimester exposures split, no neural tube defects, and a normal background rate of birth defects overall. What do you tell patients, a woman not on dolutegravir, her baby's chance of having a birth defect is? What percentage? Anybody? 1%? Actually, the background rate for all women of having a baby with a major congenital anomaly is 3%. So never counsel a patient that if she gets off her dolutegravir, her baby won't have a birth defect. You just have to counsel her that your baby has a background risk, like every other baby, of a 3%, and we're not sure about whether if it's exposed to dolutegravir or another agent, whether it would be higher or lower. We are sure, say with darunavir, that it's very unlikely that it would be higher, but never tell somebody there's no risk of a congenital anomaly. Okay, I know there are a lot of questions and concerns about the dolutegravir advisory. I would just say go on the internet. New data are coming in all the time, particularly as you review the guidelines. Even if you have a hard copy or a PDF of the perinatal guidelines, you still, when you're reading it for new information, you may want to read it right on the web, because they'll insert things, they'll have cross-references to another new set of guidelines, and I've found that very helpful as I go forward. So these are the data from Rebecca Zash et al., and I'd just like to remind you all that her first article on dolutegravir use in pregnancy this year was how great it is and what great birth outcomes they had. And it was only later that they published their finding of 4 neural tube defects among 400 women with conception exposure to dolutegravir. And here are those data. She was generous enough to bring an update on these data to the Amsterdam meetings, and I've superimposed them here in red. There's been 5 more neural tube defect reports, none of them among women who received dolutegravir during conception or the first 6 weeks of pregnancy, gestational age, so that now the prevalence among dolutegravir-exposed babies is 0.67%, which is the same as 1 case per 150 babies. And she will, when all of these exposures are recorded as live births, with or without a defect, the best possible outcome will be about 1 defect in 320 deliveries or live births, which is has a confidence interval that does overlap with other exposures, as you see going across this chart. So it still will be somewhat elevated if there are no new neural tube defects found, but it will not be statistically significant. And again, we're hoping that we get lots and lots of reports about dolutegravir exposure at the Antiretroviral Pregnancy Registry, because an independent data set, somewhat differently collected, will be very helpful in evaluating this signal. Okay, Mike Sag said, well, why don't you just put together a comparison of all the different guidelines? And I really groaned when I read that. Fortunately, Meg Daugherty of the WHO had already done that. And we see here that guidelines vary significantly. It seems that they are all in agreement, US, British, and WHO, that reliable contraception, it's fine to use dolutegravir. Not that much agreement about late pregnancy, although the data are clear. Dolutegravir is a great drug for any time after 8 weeks, 6 to 8 weeks in pregnancy. I will also say that internationally, different countries range all the way from going ahead with dolutegravir and according to woman's choice to absolutely no dolutegravir to women of childbearing age. So this is a very rapidly evolving area. There is one thing that I have not found any contradictions or inconsistency on, even though the British and WHO guidelines don't mention it. And that is for primary acute or hyperacute early infection with HIV at any time, including pregnancy, including first trimester, and including the periconceptional time, dolutegravir is still the agent of choice. So do we have to tell women you have to take it? No, you just counsel them that this is what the story is. Another drug may be just as good. We don't know. But that this is the experience out there, and that acute infection is a very unique time in control of anybody's viremia, and that we want to give them the best that we can. Okay, interestingly also, dolutegravir is still second and third line regimen choices by the WHO. So let's get on in the last couple of minutes. I just wanted to show you two cases from the 90s on the West Coast. An 18-year-old in 1996 was married. She didn't get tested for HIV. 6 months of age, the baby had a bad cough, PCP. That's how she found out she had HIV. 1998, another woman was a healthcare professional in the upper hierarchy of hospital administration. Pregnant, really healthy, declined to test politely. She had no risk factors. And again, failure to thrive at 6 months of age. Baby had PCP. So that's where we were in New York State. We've made a lot of progress, as we have everywhere. But routine opt-out testing has been the state of the art since 1999. And now in 2015, we're up to more than 96% of women being tested before they come in labor. What about retesting? Well, just very quickly, if you want to wade through all the guidelines about who's at risk and when to do it and which of 20 states your state might fall into that category of advising retesting, please be my guest. You can also consult the more recent American College of OBGYN guidelines about which patients, which of the 13 risk factors to retest women in pregnancy. I can't do that. My brain is already full enough. I just retest, and that's what I strongly recommend that you do. So what about these last residual cases? Let's just look at them as a sort of instructive opportunity. I just wanted to welcome you all to the Bronx. It was a great place to hang out when I was in high school. This is exactly what it looked like. It was kind of rough in terms of a lot of destruction, but it was a great place to hang out with your mom on a Sunday afternoon. And today it's very much different. Life expectancy has increased. And many, many things have changed. However, poverty has not left the Bronx, the South Bronx, and you see that the median household income is less than half what it is over in all of New York State. And, of course, HIV follows poverty. The same thing, seroprevalence in the South Bronx remains higher than just about anywhere else in New York City, which itself is an epicenter of the epidemic. Except perhaps for Brooklyn. Okay, and women are about one-third of those infected, higher proportion than most. In the Bronx, we see that the dominant in terms of numbers and seroprevalence is among older people, but incidence is among younger people between ages 20 and 29. Our third case, I'll just go through quickly so I can finish in the next 45 seconds. Fever of unknown origin, entire workup negative. A viral load was sent on the last day before she went home. No one ever checked it. She came into labor and delivery. They didn't see it. It didn't pop out as an abnormal lab. Baby was admitted 2 weeks later, thankfully, because a heel stick screen came back antibody positive with 600,000 copies. So how could we have missed this? Just a quick, before we end, question. Was the patient promiscuous and unreliable? Providers never asked about her partner's status. No way to detect a new HIV infection in the window period. Or the providers never checked lab results. Okay. Okay, that's right, 2 in 4. And believe me, if it could happen at my hospital, it could happen anywhere. The only problem with checking a viral load for diagnosis is that you have to check it yourself and you have to check the person you've assigned to check it. It will not pop up as an abnormal lab result, of course. So this is a tragic case that we missed and have a lot to learn from. I'll skip through case number 4 just to get to another case. This is the December 7th guidelines, which just reinforce the importance of testing and actually encouraging partners testing, which I'm going to recommend. And then we had a normal delivery, baby home, breastfeeding on postpartum day 2. Baby mom came in with flu-like symptoms at about 3 months postpartum. MRI was negative. She had the worst headache of her life. Baby came in 3 days later, coughing, not feeding well, again sent home with flu. And the bottom line was, finally, when the patient had respiratory failure, was intubated on the endotracheal aspirate, showed PCP. So this infant was hospitalized, intubated for 5 weeks, devastating neurologic damage, and this was something that we absolutely missed, even though mom was not infected at the time of her delivery. She had been separated from her husband for most of the previous 10 years and was infected while she was breastfeeding. We had asked her about her partner's status, as we routinely do now. She had no idea her husband was infected, and he wasn't telling her. So I just would like to put out to you the last slide, that our real-time case finding is not just to find infected women. We now have to, if we're going to eradicate pediatric HIV, we need to find infected partners for women who are negative. And now it's almost more dangerous to test out and be exposed than it is to test in. So I'm sorry I ran over, but I'll leave it there and take questions. Thanks a lot.
So I would like to ask a quick question. So the woman, the last case you showed, so systematically, how could things change? I'm trying to think. To pick that up. I mean, what would you...
If you could just put up the last slide. We have racked our brains about this because it was, obviously we're really torn up about it. This baby and this family have really suffered a devastating, devastating blow. And I don't think, even though it's really important to ask women if they know their partner's HIV or STI status, that's not enough. My own vision is that if we're going to send an expedited test on a woman, we have to send one on her partner, and that for routine prenatal care, in the South Bronx, partners come to prenatal visits all the time. We need to test partner on site, too. Are we doing it? No, I'm told we don't have the capacity to do it. And yet, when it's a non-HIV issue like blood typing or genetic analysis of a father's blood for whatever trait. We do it, no questions asked, no problem. Yeah, just come over here and we'll check you. So I think this is well within our means, and this is something that, seeing the new guidelines that were just issued on Friday, we're going to have a lot more ammunition to advocate for partners testing, both outside and in pregnancy.
If a woman is well controlled on dolutegravir, would you switch with a positive pregnancy test? This is sort of
Yeah, so this is absolutely very important. Could you put my slides back up? What I want to stress to you is that one of our questions on our pretest was, a woman was 3 weeks pregnant. I was just wondering, who here has ever seen a three-week pregnant woman? Okay. If she comes in, chances are she's already past the six-week gestational age, which is the same thing as the 28-day post-conceptional age, try not to get confused, where the neural tube is closed, and whether you stop or start or switch or stand on your head, that is not going to make any difference in what happened. Now, the patient may be really frightened and want to get off that dolutegravir, in which case your duty is to switch her and make sure the switch goes smoothly. You can't send her out with a prescription because she won't get it filled for a couple of weeks, and in that time she's blowing her tenofovir and her amitriptyline. You've got to enable this yourself. Speak to the pharmacist. Make sure it's going to be issued that day and that she's going to pick it up that day, because some women will not want to touch it. Other women are perfectly fine about it, and I can't predict which person is going to have which reaction. So my own feeling is, don't switch unless the patient wants to after 6 weeks. And maybe out of caution, you might want to say, well, after 8 weeks, you want to get an ultrasound right away to verify pregnancy dating. Women are incorrect all the time about how far along they are. If she's 12 weeks, that's really way beyond. And I just want to tell you that a six-week pregnancy is just identifiable on ultrasound. It's not an easy thing to see. So that chances are your patient will already be past the window, and that's the end of it. If she's not, well, then you want to address switching.
In the U equals U era, how do you counsel an HIV-negative female with an HIV-positive male couple in regards to preconception? Is there a role for PrEP, assuming the male partner is undetectable?
Yeah, we at this point we have a belts and suspenders approach to pregnant women. It may be overkill, but the safety data are very compelling, so that we offer PrEP and PEP even when the partner is undetectable. So we've had one woman who didn't want them. She was fine. They used condoms all the time, and partner was highly adherent and suppressed for years, and everything was fine. But we do offer that and really push for it a bit, you know, but it's still the patient's choice. I just would add that you got to do an awful lot with nursing colleagues in the clinic and on labor and delivery, and especially postpartum. They need to be prepared for the fact that a woman is going to be admitted who is going to nurse her baby even though she's taking HIV meds, and you're going to get tons of pushback, but you get much less pushback if you prepare everybody for this. It makes a huge difference.
Thank you for a great presentation. I wanted to know your clinical experience with women who agree to do antiretroviral therapy with pregnancy and what their level of continuation is after delivery.
So it's not great. I think I see more success in our program in the Bronx because we're on site and, you know, we're sort of housed all together. And so we see the clinicians see each other every day. I can bounce into an office, an ID or a pediatric colleague can bounce into my office, but it's not as good as it could be. And I think this is one of the great challenges that we have never addressed adequately, is how to enhance and assure postpartum adherence. I've always been disappointed that we never did a lot more with creative solutions like, you know, an infant never misses a dose of AZT. Never. A mother never forgets it, but she always forgets her own dosing. I don't know why we've never put together dosing packs so that she takes her meds right before she gives the baby her baby's meds, and that's the way it works. And we can explain it to them, like being on an airplane and the oxygen mask thing and all of that. But that's, I guess that'll be something to do when I get home. I just, it's been a great disappointment. Yeah.
So we have a couple questions that are similar. What antiretrovirals do you recommend for a woman who want to become pregnant? And one was the same question specifically about bictegravir.
So I think, you know, it very much depends on what's best for her. Even without dolutegravir and bictegravir, there's just a wealth of possibilities. And, you know, I don't personally understand why the rilpivirine combinations aren't mentioned more in the guidelines and or even here. I think that's great. It works well. People like it. Adherence is fabulous on it. And even though we don't have a lot of data on rilpivirine, at least we're not terrifying women about it. I've never been that crazy about Atripla because of the psychiatric problems, and I just really feel for people who would have to go through exacerbation of whatever problems they have. So I think that there are many, many possibilities. I don't think that the advantage of dolutegravir and bictegravir immediately vastly outweigh the disadvantages of other therapies that we have a little bit more experience with.
I had a question about breastfeeding in virologically suppressed women.
Wow,
does
that's
U
this
equal
question.
U apply?
Nice.
So, you know, we could do a morning on this topic. And there's an isolated case in the U.S. that has been reported. I don't have a slide on that. And everybody's very, very worried about that. Certainly the risk of transmission is low. I can tell you we were all set for one of our moms who is an experienced breastfeeding mom from Africa, for her to nurse her baby, and PEDS was going to put the baby on a nevirapine-based prophylactic regimen with one or two more drugs, I forget how many. And then she came up with K103N, and they talked her out of it, and now she's not. I really worry about that because I think the fallback may not be, or it's a chance that the fallback will not be to abstain from breastfeeding, but it will be to lie. And this is, when you get that kind of disconnect, that's the danger. So I'm not sure what's going to happen to her. I've offered her cabergoline, which I think we should use for women who aren't going to nurse their kids. Why should they suffer with horrible breast engorgement and get febrile, and you're not going to know what's going on? So I do offer that. And the other thing is that I've just read an article that now raltegravir-based therapies are recommended for newborns. What about for prophylaxis? So it's rapidly evolving.
And last question, very quick. Concerns about TAF versus tenofovir?
So I just can't get that excited about TAF versus tenofovir. If someone's on TDF, I certainly continue it. If someone's stable on TAF, I don't see a big reason to switch it. Especially since you're probably, once a client knows she's pregnant, unless she's being followed in an infertility clinic with pregnancy tests every 2 days and all of that, it's going to be past the so-called teratogenic window. So I think it's fine. I don't think anybody would object for someone being on TDF for a few months or a year before they update their treatment to newer available agents. She doesn't have to be on it for the rest of her life.
Thank you. Thank you very much.